This is The Guardian.
Today, as its war in Gaza rages on, why is Israel's government at risk of collapse?
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
For the past 6 months, Israel's been fighting a war in Gaza that's left more than 30,000 Palestinians dead, the country's international reputation severely damaged, and which, so far, has failed in its goal of defeating Hamas. But that entire time, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been fighting another war, one for his own political survival. The war in Gaza has no end in sight. Just yesterday, Israel admitted to killing, by accident it said, 7 international aid workers, including 3 from the UK, adding to growing global disgust over the conflict.
We really need to get rid of Bibi Netanyahu, unfortunately. He doesn't do his work as good as we think he does.
And now, with massive protests on the streets of Israeli cities, major allies saying this war must end, and a political crisis at the heart of his ruling coalition, Netanyahu's other battle, the one to stay in power, might be heading towards defeat. From The Guardian, I'm Michael Safi. Today in Focus, the political crisis that could finally bring down Israel's Prime Minister. Bethan McKernan, you're The Guardian's Jerusalem correspondent. And to understand why Israel finds itself at a breaking point right now, I want to go back not to October 7, the horrendous attacks that morning, but actually to the day before, October 6. What was the state of Israel's politics back then?
Israel's politics back then was extremely divided, extremely fractured, in a way that was kind of unprecedented in the history of the state. It's very polarized, but mainly because of the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. He came back to office right at the end of 2022 with this new far-right coalition, and they were trying to pass a package of judicial reforms, which basically ignited massive street protests and really bitter and sharp divides in the body politic over people who thought that it was needed to reform what is basically an unelected, very powerful body, and people who thought that it amounted to democratic backsliding. So it was a really tricky moment.
And it was really tricky for Netanyahu personally, because he's under investigation on a number of charges that he denies, but which could still land him in jail.
Okay, breaking news to bring to you. Israel's attorney general has indicted the prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, on multiple corruption charges.
We've covered those allegations a few times on the show. The point here is that on the morning of October 7, Israel was as bitterly divided as it's ever been. And then it gets attacked. This horrific attack by Hamas and other militants that leaves more than 1,000 people dead. What happens to those huge divisions in Israel in the aftermath of that attack?
I mean, I guess the initial reaction after October the 7th was shock, but we also saw a real drive from Israel's political establishment to form a unity government and a unity war cabinet. And there was a sense that everybody had to, you know, drop the things that they were arguing about the day before and come together, because Israel was under such an existential threat, and nothing as terrible had ever happened in the country's history. It was the most deadly day in Israeli history.
United in shock, Israelis have come together to back their military, who are now massing on the border with Gaza ahead of an expected land incursion. And today, Prime Minister Netanyahu and his political rival Benny Gantz announced that they would form an emergency government to handle this crisis.
So in this newly formed unity cabinet that was formed in the next day or two, Netanyahu's biggest rival, Benny Gantz, the leader of a centrist opposition party, put aside all of the political disagreements that he had with Netanyahu and the government to, you know, for the greater good of Israel, is how they put it. And Netanyahu's defense minister, Yoav Gallant, he's also a member of Netanyahu's Likud party, but he was kind of the most vocal critic on the government's benches of the government and of the judicial reform. And he kind of fell in line as well. And very much the three men presented this united front. They were giving joint press conferences. They were wearing the same clothes. They were all wearing black. They were kind of really trying to portray this united front. That was like the image that they wanted to show.
Interesting, because you would think after an attack of that magnitude, there would be political questions to be answered. But it sounds like everyone was saying, we'll get to those, but for now, we need to hang together.
Yeah, I think the feeling of threats was just so big and people were so scared. It really was a society-wide need, I think, for everybody to rally together and face the threats in a united way, because there's kind of a latent feeling that how divided and the disunity in Israel before that may have even have been one of the reasons why Hamas attacked.
As the war gets underway last October, how quickly do we begin to see protesters return to Israeli streets?
Very quickly, actually. You know, in the first kind of week, the father of a family that had been taken hostage to Gaza, he went and sat outside the Kiria, the defense headquarters in Tel Aviv, and he said that he would sit there until they brought his family home. And he was really quickly joined by the relatives and friends of other hostages, and then increasingly, you know, every week by more and more and more slices of mainstream Israeli society.
I'm here because I want to make sure that it's loud and clear that the first priority should be bringing them home now. We have almost 200 people out there, and we're not leaving wounded behind. This is a saying in Hebrew.
I came here, this is where decisions are being made in Israel. If I could go to the center of Gaza and do the same thing, I would. And I ask Hamas, which is holding my family, I hope again in good health, please stop, and the Israeli government to please stop and just bring the women and children back.
אחת מתוך 120 כרגע שאנחנו יודעים, אני בטוחה שיש עוד הרבה שלא יודעים עליהם. כולם צריכים להיות בבית עכשיו, לא מחר, לא מחרתיים, עכשיו. אחר כך שיעשו מה שהם רוצים. אבל היא צריכה להיות בבית עכשיו כמו כולם. לא יכול להיות שם ילדים ונשים.
And so on Israel's streets, that united front started to crack pretty quickly. What about in this newly formed war cabinet? At what point did you begin to see that the divisions in there would not be so easily suppressed?
I think there's definitely a divide between the Netanyahu camp, him and the sort of the far right of his government, who are not in the war cabinet, but, you know, they still have a role in the larger security cabinet and in the functions of government, who keep pressing this line of Israel must have total victory over Hamas in Gaza. That's been the line since October the 7th. And 6 months later, it's still the line. But then the sort of more pragmatic camp within the war cabinet, kind of represented, I guess, most forcefully by Benny Gantz, they haven't said it out loud, but it's clear that they think that this idea of total victory can't be achieved. You know, like, what does that even mean? And they're kind of more willing to think about the day after in Gaza and what mechanisms are going to be needed to govern or manage this population, and whether Israel is going to reoccupy it with ground forces, or whether an international peacekeeping force could come in, or whether the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank could somehow be reformed and invited back into Gaza. You know, these are really huge issues.
So Beth, until now, Netanyahu has just about managed to keep his coalition together and navigate the competing demands of different factions across the country. But looking at Israel this week, it feels like that show of unity has now completely crumbled. Tell me about what you're seeing out there.
The last couple of weeks, the street protests we've seen all over Israel. So streets of Tel Aviv, the streets of Jerusalem, Haifa, Be'er Sheva, Sazera, you know, these are the biggest street protests that Israel's ever seen.
We came to call on them, on this government to resign. This is a government that has failed us repeatedly from last year, that when they tried to pass the judicial overhaul on October 7th, when so many people have died and they couldn't help us. And from October 8th and on, they're still neglecting us.
What they're calling for is early elections. They want the government to go, because this kind of treading water of keeping the war going as long as possible, because Netanyahu thinks that if he does that, then he can stave off early elections.
The people of Israel demand from the government to find solution to release all the hostages. They are simply dying there, and the government ought to do their duty and release all of them. If they are unable to do so, maybe someone else can do that.
Other than early elections, the other big demand of everybody who's out on the streets at the moment is a hostage deal, is to bring the hostages home. And there hasn't been a deal since November, and the talks keep getting postponed, or they keep breaking up without breakthroughs, and people are just so frustrated. They now think, I think, that it's time for a change in tactics to force the government to come up with a deal. And things are getting not violent. The protest movement in Israel is generally pretty good at staying non-violent, but the police have been responding with, you know, increasing levels of force, so using things like water cannon, and protesters have been blocking highways and roads. And most notably, I guess, it seems like some of the biggest trade unions might be getting involved again. And if that happens, we might see them shutting down Israel's only airport, crippling kind of Israeli infrastructure in that way. That's something that even Netanyahu has to take notice of. He can't ignore that.
Netanyahu has withstood nationwide protests before, but this time he also faces a serious political danger in the form of a bill to do with whether the country's extremely religious ultra-Orthodox community should be forced to serve in the army, the same way most other Jewish Israelis are forced to. Tell me about that ultra-Orthodox community and why this issue poses so much danger to Netanyahu.
So at the beginning of the founding of Israel back in 1948, there was only something like 400 ultra-Orthodox men who were eligible for military service. And the founder of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, exempted them because he thought that rebuilding Jewish culture and Torah study was an important part of creating this new state, rising up from the ashes of the Holocaust. That wasn't an issue when they were basically a tiny minority in the country, but the population has grown and grown and grown over the decades. And now the ultra-Orthodox community make up about 13% of Israel's 9 million people. So that's a huge proportion. And the rest of Jewish Israeli society sees them as getting a free ride because they don't have to do military service. something like 13,000 ultra-Orthodox young men should be eligible to be enlisted in the army every year, but according to the IDF, they only ever get around 1,200 people. So it causes a lot of friction and resentment with the other sections of Israel who just think it's not fair. You know, they send their kids off to die in Gaza, in the West Bank, on the Northern Front, and this community not only doesn't have to do that, their entire lifestyle is subsidized by taxpayers like them, by people who work. So it's a cultural kind of clash that has been brewing for years, but has reached a kind of point of no return at this point.
And so why has it reached a point of no return now?
There's a law on the books in Israel that temporarily exempts yeshiva students from having to do their military service, and it gets extended every year almost without fail. But this year, because of the war in Gaza, Gantz and Gallant started making noises about how, because of the pressure and the burden on Israeli soldiers and on reservists who make up something like 70% of the armed forces, that this situation has reached a tipping point where it has to change, and the ultra-Orthodox community is going to have to start contributing to the war effort. And for the ultra-Orthodox parties, this is a raison d'etre for them even being in government, right? Like, they represent their community. I mean, there have been counter-protests in a few different places in the last few days of ultra-Orthodox men, and the placards and stuff that they're holding say, you know, I'd rather go to jail than join the military. I'd rather die than join the military.
We prefer dying, we prefer filling the jails. To the army we're not going, full stop.
It's a really fundamental issue for them. For Netanyahu, his major allies are ultra-Orthodox politicians and their bases. You know, he needs those votes. So the question is, what is Netanyahu gonna do?
The unity around this conflict isn't just beginning to fracture inside Israel. Globally, we've also started to see Israel's allies voicing concern, even criticizing the war, in the face of an imminent famine in Gaza, according to the WHO, the deaths on Tuesday of 7 international aid workers, and the ongoing looming threat to the city of Rafah. What is all of that doing to the international solidarity around Israel?
I mean, the longer the war goes on and the more horrific the conditions for people in Gaza become, I mean, you just mentioned, right, you know, a quarter of the population is currently facing famine. The less support internationally Israel is attracting. We kind of saw that very definitively last week at the UN Security Council when the US didn't use its veto like it normally does as a permanent member of the Security Council to protect Israel.
The result of the voting is as follows. 14 votes in favor, 0 vote against, 1 abstention. The draft resolution has been adopted as Resolution 2728-2024.
I mean, on one level, that's kind of symbolic. But on another level, you know, this is Biden and the White House kind of belatedly showing Netanyahu that there are consequences to his actions and to his rhetoric.
That resolution and Monday's decision to abstain are the latest glaring signs of the Biden administration's frustration with Israel's approach to its war on Hamas in Gaza. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is the source of the Biden administration's frustration, reacted angrily to the U.S. vote to abstain.
And how was that received in Israel, that the most important and staunchest ally in the world is beginning to waver?
A lot of Israelis feel kind of abandoned by the rest of the world. You know, they wonder how support for them could have been so high on October the 7th and in the days after that, and how it kind of waned and disappeared. And I mean, the answer to that has been the death toll in Gaza. But to a lot of Israelis, the war isn't finished, Hamas isn't defeated, and they don't understand how they kind of feel betrayed by the rest of the world turning against them. A lot of people feel that way.
Listening to you talk about how openly divided Israel is now, how difficult its relationships with its allies have become, it makes me think that the country fighting this war today is a lot more like the Israel that existed on October 6th than the one that tried to rally together after October 7th.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. And I think the common denominator here is Netanyahu. Everything, every debate here, every political crisis here, the conduct of the war, you know, whether there's going to be a war in the north of Lebanon, you know, all of these issues and crises are interrelated and they all go through this one man. So for a growing part of the international community, as well as his people at home, people really feel that Netanyahu has to go. They feel that he is prolonging the war because he's afraid of being prosecuted on these long-standing corruption charges if he leaves office. And Netanyahu has essentially been the driving political and cultural force in Israel for the better part of the last 20 years. And, you know, one of his biographers writes that he's reshaped the country in his image. And I think that's really true. And the blame for October the 7th, he's, you know, he was the prime minister when that happened. I think these are consequences that eventually he won't be able to escape, but he's going to try really damn hard in the meantime to not have to face them.
Coming up, he's Israel's longest-serving prime minister ever, but is time running out for Benjamin Netanyahu?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Beth, when you look at the polls of the Israeli public, what do they say about whether Netanyahu should still be in power?
Well, I mean, if there were an election tomorrow, Netanyahu would be very unlikely to be returned as prime minister because he is extremely unpopular and his far-right secular allies are very unpopular. The votes that would go to his ultra-Orthodox allies kind of remain stable because the most important indicator of voting intention in Israel is religion and ethnicity. So, you know, that block kind of remains quite stable. But he is unpopular and he would go, but that doesn't mean that the war effort would stop. Polling shows that people are still very much in favor of the war effort.
Okay, this sounds pretty key. You're saying that if Netanyahu was to fall, if someone like Benny Gantz, the former defense minister, were to inherit this war, he may not fight it any differently to the way Netanyahu is.
I think it is quite possible that even a new, more left-wing or more centrist government, it's quite possible they would continue to fight this war the way it's currently being fought under Netanyahu's stewardship. Israel doesn't have a kind of moment of victory to point to yet, right? Like they haven't found or captured Yahya Sinwar, the head of Hamas in Gaza. They haven't got total control of the whole of the Gaza Strip. They kind of need a victory image. They need something to show the Israeli public that the sacrifices that they've made in the last 6 months are not for nothing. And that is a problem that whoever succeeds Netanyahu would inherit.
This is as close as Netanyahu has come to political ruin in a long time. Knowing him, knowing his career, do you think he'll find a way out of it, to hang on to power yet again?
He's often known as King Bibi, right? Like that's his nickname. It's because he's a really masterful political operator and he's managed to extricate himself from seemingly impossible problems and situations, both on a personal and a political level before. So I think he probably will convince the ultra-Orthodox parties to stay in his coalition because they don't really have other options. And I think they know that too, and they know that they're unlikely to get any of the issues that they want passed and the funding for their communities and subsidies for yeshiva study, all that kind of thing is going to be much harder to pass with a more centrist government. So Netanyahu's kind of their best option. I think they need each other. It still could bring him down. It could. I just think that I think he will probably find a way. It's going to be really hard work. He's really got his work cut out for him to kind of appease his ultra-Orthodox coalition partners because they're so angry about this development. But I think if anyone can do it, he will do it. Otherwise, there'll be new elections and he wouldn't win. He wouldn't win. So he'll do anything he can to keep this coalition intact.
Bethan, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And that was Bethan McKernan, The Guardian's Jerusalem correspondent, whose work you can find at theguardian.com. We also have a live blog on the war and have since October 7. It's still going 6 months on and has all the latest updates every day. You can find it at The Guardian website. And that is it for today. This episode was produced by Natalie Ktena, Oscar Boyd and Tom Glasser. Sound design was by Rudy Segadlo. The executive producer was Phil Maynard. We're back with you tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.